This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. A true crime podcast in Australia hit number one on the charts there back in September, and there is a major Central Coast connection. Instead of diving into a murder investigation, as the genre usually focuses on, season four of the Unravel podcast, titled Snowball, zeroes in on what they call love fraud. It revolves around a mysterious woman and the family she allegedly defrauded, and one family member's obsession with finding her that took him all the way across the world, right here to the Central Coast, tracking down another alleged victim in Paso Robles, and even confronting the woman at the center of it all in San Luis Obispo. Here's a quick preview.
My brother married an American con artist.
I find myself in a murky world of con artists and swindlers.
This isn't the kind of story you would expect to happen to a pretty average Kiwi family like mine.
I was just gobsmacked as to what's going on here.
I just remember it being like, whoa.
She had this dark, vivacious...
And then, whoa.
A surfer's skin and look to her.
And then after like two or three woes...
She's a sociopath.
It wasn't really a surprise. You're like... I wonder what the next woe is going to be.
What happened cost us everything.
I held it up to the light and everything merged.
In the end, my parents lost more than $1 million.
We'd been done.
Mum and Dad ended up homeless.
We're destroyed.
I'm going to travel across the world to track Leslie down.
What are we getting ourselves into?
Okay. I'm running.
Stand by.
I'm Ollie Wards, and I want you to come with me.
The snowball.
For the new season of Unravel.
Is about to hit you.
This time, things really do get personal.
She's walking just in front of you, bro.
Where?
In the middle.
Join me for Snowball.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I see her.
Ollie Wards is a 34-year-old radio producer from New Zealand who works at the Australian broadcasting company called ABC. He's been behind the scenes of their programming for a few years until he got the green light last year to produce his own podcast for their true crime series. It's about his brother's whirlwind marriage to a woman from the United States, her subsequent disappearance, and the family's claim that she defrauded them over $1 million. I recently Skyped with Wards in Australia to learn about the podcast, this mysterious woman, and his trip to the Central Coast.
It all started 10 years ago when my middle brother, so we're a pretty average family from New Zealand, and my brother Greg is obsessed with everything to do with America. He calls himself an Americanophile, and he loves reading all about the news and the politics of the States. And he was a backpacker in London in his mid-20s, and he met an American woman in her late 30s, and he fell in love. Was totally obsessed with her crazy stories of running international restaurants and being chased out of Hawaii by murderous local mobsters. And eventually they came back to New Zealand where they got married. But only a few months later, she left. And when he took her to the airport, he thought she was just going on a holiday back to California to visit her family. And the last thing she said to him was, "The snowball is about to hit you." And it ended up with my family losing our home. My parents had sort of unwittingly become the guarantors of a $1.5 million loan for her. And after she left, it turned out that, you know, there's fake documents, alter egos. It's almost kind of like a catch me if you can style story. And that's what I've been investigating over the last year.
And so what year was this when they got married, and then when did she take off for the United States?
Yeah, that was at the end of 2007, and they had obviously met in Europe, but they got married at the end of 2007 and she left in March 2008. So it was only a few months later, and none of us ever saw her again after that.
So you mentioned the $1.5 million. That's Australian dollars. I think that calculates to just a little bit over $1 million in US dollars.
Even less, it was New Zealand dollars. So, and at the time, I mean, the American dollar's been pretty high. So, yeah, would it be about just over two, I reckon.
Well, let's go ahead and break that down. I think people would be interested to know what led your family to loan her this much money and to give her that responsibility of that much money, and then what happened to it.
Yeah, that's right. So she actually got the loan from a New Zealand bank, and to get the loan from the bank, she had to convince them that she had this big American trust fund that she always talked about. She showed them a document, which I've managed to recover, a Bank of America statement showing that she had $5 million in the bank. But that Bank of America statement turned out to be fake, and it's actually quite a bad fake. She makes her fake documents with scissors and glue in a photocopier rather than Photoshop on a computer. So she managed to secure the bank loan, but my parents were unfortunately guarantors for that loan. They never saw her dealings with the bank, so she sort of duped them as well. But they then bought a cafe, a restaurant sort of business, and that's the area that she always said she worked in. She had been sending money back to America, which we were able to find out a little bit later. But before she left, there was things starting to seem strange, but nothing seriously untoward. And it was really after she left that the snowball that she mentioned to my brother really hit and everything was gone.
Now, what did that mean, the snowball is about to hit you?
I think that was her acknowledging that there was a whole lot of, basically a house of cards that she had built that was going to fall down, and it was going to fall down soon. She was probably getting out of the place before that happened, and that's turned out to be the pattern of what she does. The same thing happened in Hawaii. It's happened in Paso Robles after us. So part of the story is me investigating the pattern of this around the world. And unfortunately, if I found a guy in Paso Robles that it happened to after us, and you hear about him in the podcast and how similar the story is.
I mean, was your brother obviously pretty distraught after not hearing his wife leaves and never sees her again?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty tough when your marriage sort of falls apart just a few months after you get married. But for my brother, it sort of took the whole family down with him. And it was devastating. You know, he had to come to terms with somebody that he truly loved leaving and never coming back, but also seeing parents lose the home that we all grew up in together. Everybody started finding out that, you know, she wasn't who she said she was. That, and at that point, everybody kind of brings up things that she had said that didn't add up for them. And people kind of say, oh, I knew something was up, or I knew she wasn't quite who she said she was. So from quite a few angles, he was feeling pretty devastated over that time where the family crumbled a little bit, his relationship did, and it was all because he had fallen in love with somebody who is basically a known con artist.
So you just mentioned people looking back and saying, you know, that didn't seem right. Was there anything that happened at the time when they were together that just didn't feel right to you, your family, or him?
Yeah, so I was living overseas most of the time. So I met her briefly when they were together in the UK, and then I flew back to New Zealand to MC the wedding. And there were quite a few things that she would tell you about. I mentioned before she had the story about being run out of Hawaii by the mafia who were trying to kill her because she had got engaged with them in some sort of business deal at her bar there. And I was going, oh yeah, okay, it seems pretty full on. But you know, the way she would tell it, she would be really dogged in the way that she would give you all the details. So it seemed to add up. But then the next time she would tell it, it would be slightly different. But in New Zealand, people are quite, I guess, there's a certain humility and an understatement, and people don't usually kind of big note themselves. And when people do that, everyone else gets a little bit shy about it. So I think there was a cultural difference there that allowed her to, she was this Californian power business lady coming in, shaking things up. And, you know, here are all these sort of Kiwis from New Zealand who didn't really know what to say. So we all just let her go around telling all these stories. And, you know, there was other ones like she hung out with rock stars and all these famous people in America. But when it came time for them to get married and for this huge wedding that we had, only two people from her side came, her parents. She had all these trust fund friends, all these rock star friends. And then out of about 150 guests, the only two that came from her side were her parents. So there were alarm bells and everyone thought it was weird, but we just sort of went, oh, okay, and moved on.
Now, didn't you mention that some people almost thought that they were paid actors?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of guests at the wedding seemed to think that the parents didn't really act like her parents. And there's a really strange relationship there. So her story is that she was a baby in Armenia and was smuggled out as a refugee baby. But her biological parents left a massive trust fund for her, this millions of dollars that she claimed, and that she was adopted by this family in Buena Park in California. And that seemed to be quite a strange backstory. And then when her parents turned up, they were very quiet, didn't say much. Her mum, I said, she had almost permanently pursed lips, and her dad had this sort of squint through glasses that was somehow at the same time suspicious and disinterested. And they just sort of stood around, and everyone was like, okay, this is weird. We thought that the dad was supposedly rich from selling tanks to the US Army. But it turned out that he was in fact selling water tanks to the Army. So when somebody tells you they're selling tanks to the Army, you don't think water tanks. But so all of this stuff was kind of out there, but it's really hard to draw a dotted line between one or two strange things to something broader. And when you've got a family member, when you've got a brother, a son, or a friend who seems really happy and seems in love, it's whose place is it to kind of start calling out these strange things and take them aside and say, I don't think this adds up.
Well, obviously things did not end well in this relationship, and she was not heard from again. And did people in your family try to reach out and contact her, and it just with no success for a long period of time?
No, there was some contact when she got back to the States. There were letters exchanged. There were a few phone calls. My dad hired a private investigator to help at one point, and they tracked her down. And the New Zealand police were involved, but there's a jurisdiction thing here as well, where they basically said she's left the country, and there's a border alert in place for her if she ever came back to the country, but they're not able to come and get her in California, which does seem to be something that she's worked to her advantage. And in my investigation, I've been dealing with the US justice system and the various actions that have been taken against her, even within California, different counties. And then some of the stuff she's done in Hawaii and then in the UK as well. When you're swapping borders and jurisdictions, it's quite hard for white collar crimes to catch up with you.
Wow. So about a decade goes by between when she leaves and then you decide to pick this up as a podcast. Can you break down what happened with your brother and you and your family during this time?
Initially, what happened is my family had to kind of pull together to try and save the business that she had bought. But unfortunately, the bank foreclosed on that, and it was the very same bank that had accepted all the fake documents and like bad fake documents as her credentials. She has a lawyer who acts on her behalf, and this is a real kicker. When my dad became quite obsessed with investigating everything and trying to understand what happened, he managed to gain access to her emails. And so for about a year and a half, my dad was logging in and basically copy-pasting her emails and being able to see what she was doing. And it turns out that there's almost like a fight club kind of situation between her name's Leslie and this lawyer called Eric, who it seems is actually her. So she creates and plays the role of this sort of fake lawyer who was liaising with the bank in New Zealand. I've got the letters that he wrote to the bank. I've got emails that he even sends to her. So it becomes this kind of psychological hall of mirrors where trying to unpick whether this guy's real or not, or whether it's just her other personality, is really what we started investigating. My dad became obsessed with it, and that's what I've been looking into all these years later.
Tell me about the move to turn this into a podcast and start documenting and recording all this.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange thing. I sort of said to somebody that it's almost like taking your family's dirty laundry, hanging it on the washing line, and inviting the neighborhood around to have a look at it, because it's definitely a really personal story. And working at a radio station myself, I'm often helping other people tell stories. And I started thinking about this one, thinking, yeah, hang on. And I didn't know a lot about it. So I went home to New Zealand from Australia. And when I got there, I started asking my dad about it. And I had a microphone with me. And the more he started telling me, the more I was facepalming, going, this is a bit crazy. So I turned the microphone on and That's when I realized I had something here, and I pitched the story to the ABC, which, like I said, is the NPR equivalent in Australia. They loved it, and here I am, having just released it. It's the latest season of their true crime series called Unravel.
I was wondering, with such a crazy story, why this wasn't the first one. So you just approached them after a couple of seasons and said, hey, by the way, I have this crazy story we should dive into.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, podcasts and the true crime kind of genre have become really big over the last few years. The first three seasons of Unravel are about unsolved murders. And, you know, I'm sure you've listened to podcasts, Serial, obviously the one that kind of blew this genre up, where there's a real sense of blood and guts and gore and kind of unsolved murders. And they tend to be tragically of poor, innocent young women. But this story kind of follows on from, I guess, what Dirty John started, the LA Times Wondery story of more white collar kind of con artistry and narcissists and sociopaths convincing people of somebody that they're not. So I think this story actually represents a bit of a change in the trend of true crime podcasts to look at more love fraud and the sort of more nuanced crime that's less blood and guts than the unsolved murders. And there's a lot in my story that's actually just genuinely funny. It's almost like a comedy true crime, because some of her, like I said, her fake documents are so bad that you wonder how professionals at a bank would let them go past. Like I said, this you know, this kind of fake lawyer that she has is quite entertaining. A lot of it's actually just genuinely funny. So it's season four because it's maybe representing a different direction. And there's a different host and journalist for each of the seasons.
So as part of the podcast, you come to the United States and you come to the central coast of California, where we are. Tell us about getting here and your arrival and your experiences while you were here. First impressions?
Yeah, so I had to tap in my oldest brother, not the one that was married to Leslie, but my oldest brother is a bit of a security guard, I guess. But we landed in LA, and, you know, it was bright and sunny, and there was lots of palm trees like we expected. He wasn't stoked that I had hired the hatchback economy rental car, so he insisted on a muscle car upgrade. And we ended up, you know, there's a lot of iconography that we have about America and about California that is, being from the other side of the world, we still watch all the movies, we still watch all the TV shows. And when we got there and we were driving around in this Dodge muscle car, we put some Hawaiian shirts on and listened to some West Coast hip hop. We kind of thought, yeah, we're really detectives here. We're really doing this. And we were quite pumped up. And a lot of it felt like we were in a movie. And then as we made our way into places in California that I'd never heard of, like San Luis Obispo or Paso Robles, we started to meet more and more people that had encountered this person and that had been conned, lied to, you know, convinced of a reality that wasn't the case. And it started getting quite dark, and we ended up, one of the places we went was in Paso Robles. There's literally a saloon from the Wild West where Jesse James the Gunslinger had hung out in it, and we had to go in there and interview people, and it felt quite gangster, and we were pretty nervous. You know, there's a, like I said, we know a lot about America, and a lot of it is kind of scary. So it was a couple of Kiwi boys in the big pond trying to swim.
Well, what did you end up finding out about Leslie while you were in the Central Coast here in Paso Robles and San Luis Obispo?
Yeah, so we found a gentleman who we call Cameron in the podcast, who had amazingly similar story to my brother, almost a mirror image. And unfortunately, it was after she had left New Zealand, and she rolled out the same playbook and convinced this guy to invest a lot of his money into a restaurant that she would run. She was allegedly sort of embezzling money out of it, writing checks in his name and cashing them. And eventually, when it was discovered, she left Paso Robles with a bit of a trail of destruction behind her. And then I was following, every time I'd meet somebody, they would say, oh, you should go and speak to this other person. And then that person would give me another clue. And it led me to find out that she works in a supermarket there in San Luis Obispo. So we had to basically do a stakeout of the supermarket. We parked in our muscle car in the car park and watched as people came and went, because we were worried that as soon as she knew we were there, she would either go to ground or she would potentially have somebody that would, you know, be some muscle over us. Eventually I did spot her, and I just approached her. I had microphone, there was a guy filming, and I had a chat to her, and I expected her to drive away because I got to her just as her car door was closing, and I said, "Hey, Leslie, it's Ollie," and she said, "Hello," and we talked for about half an hour in that car park of the supermarket in San Luis Obispo, and she's very convincing. She's very good at this kind of stuff, and you hear this in the podcast where I'm putting all these accusations to her, and she most of the time she has an answer, but you end up coming away from it realizing that this is somebody who can lie very well.
This video, which is on your website, is a little tough to watch because you can tell that there's a suspense in trying to get her, and then you do get her in her car, and you can tell that, you know, she doesn't want to talk to you, but then she also opens up a little bit, and then you can get the sense that you want to get the conversation now or you may never get her again. So it is a tough watch. What did you learn from this interaction?
I learned that confidence is everything, and I actually didn't know that con artist, that's what it means, confidence artist. And it's all about presenting yourself as, no, there's no problem here. And as long as you have a story and stick to it, that can actually be all you need. As implausible as the story might be, if you seem confident about it, that can build trust in the people you're talking to. So I had been looking at these fake documents and police reports and court records for literally months. And then when I was there face to face with her and she was smiling and saying, no, there must be a mistake, it was almost like a Jedi mind trick where I was kind of going, oh, maybe there is no mistake. There is a mistake here. That's one thing I learned, is that people who are able to lie that well, I think maybe even lie to themselves and convince themselves so well that they can overcome any facts that are put in front of them. I mean, I did show her some documents at the time and she kind of said, oh, no, I don't know what to tell you about those. But I also learned that empathy for other people is not universal. That you often think that everybody has the ability to feel sorry if they've hurt somebody, to understand that their actions might have affected somebody else. But with this person, and I guess it's the definition of a sociopath and a psychopath, is they don't feel empathy, and they can academically understand it and they can use that against other people, but in some circumstances people don't really care if they've hurt anybody.
Interesting. So did you talk to the local authorities while you were here? Were you able to talk to the police, let them know what was going on, and if so, what did they say?
Yeah, so I've reached out to various arms of the American justice system, and I would underline various arms because it's just amazing how there's county police, state police, various other law enforcement. I wrote to the FBI. The list goes on. And essentially, the evidence that we have from New Zealand was investigated by the New Zealand police, but it wasn't enough for them to transfer a file without speaking to her to the American police. So without that, I didn't have anything new to present them. But what I did discover is that she had various actions against her in Hawaii, and I got in touch with the Hawaiian police, who sort of had some sort of bureaucratic stuff up, where I talked to the chief of the Maui police and I presented him with the police reports from the time, and then I spoke to the Hawaiian prosecutor's office, who said they never got those reports from the police. And the chief of the Maui County police said to me, oh, I don't know what happened. I think his words were, these got lost in the shuffle. So she was able to just get away from Hawaii. And in California, the gentleman who she conned in Paso Robles didn't actually go to the police, and he didn't want to drag himself back through it. He said that when this kind of thing happens to you, you sometimes just want to pick up your life and move on. And that's actually something I learned from this investigation and speaking to experts, is that a lot of victims of love fraud and con artists actually don't go to law enforcement because they feel humiliated. A lot of it, the writing was on the wall. They might have even had friends and family telling them that this was going to happen, so they feel embarrassed. And of course, when things go to the police, it becomes public knowledge, so they often just don't tell the police. And without him as the witness, I couldn't go forward with the law enforcement in the States.
And for anyone listening that isn't familiar, you know, New Zealand is a much smaller country than the United States. What were some big takeaways from the difference between your police system and our police system?
Well, the big takeaway is that there's only one. The New Zealand police are very active. They're, you know, they're a highly professional force. I think the chief of the fraud group that I interviewed for the podcast and was looking at the file at the time said that to commence proceedings internationally and to the United States is a massive expense. It's very difficult to do, and it was essentially something that the bar was too high to get over, and therefore once she had left New Zealand she would just get away. Basically they placed a border alert in case she ever comes back. But what I learned about the American justice system is that the jurisdictions are so different between one another that it can be really hard to actually link up. For example, the counties, some of them have online searches for records, some of them don't. I recovered a document that she had given to somebody, which was a City of Buena Park criminal history check, but it was only for the city. What's the point of having a criminal history check from the boundaries of a city? I learned that there's a lot of enforcement agencies, a lot of jurisdictions, and a lot of opportunities for criminals who understand that to actually bounce around between them and get away, basically.
Without giving away too much of your podcast, which you obviously want people to listen to, what would you like people out here to know here on the Central Coast? Is there any reason to be concerned that there is a frauder in our midst, or possibly?
I learned how common this stuff is, and there's obviously different scales. I mean, there's, you know, the Catch Me If You Can movie, which this reminded me of a lot, right down to people who just add a bit of mayonnaise onto their stories to make themselves sound a bit better. And I think being aware of that there are people that are willing to lie to loved ones out there is a good thing to be aware of. And their nefarious reasons for doing it might range from just wanting to big note themselves up to actually stealing your money. And I think look out for inconsistencies in people's backstories. If people show large, grandiose scales of affection and give gifts that seem beyond the relationship, that's a warning sign. If people don't want you to meet their family and friends, that's often a warning sign. And one thing that might trouble you is that California, Hawaii, New Zealand, places that are beautiful, places that have a tropical setting, for some reason tend to attract these people, because often the populations are transient. She was in Tahoe as well. The populations are transient. People make connections really fast because of tourism industries and that kind of thing. They are rife with con artists and people who are out to scam you.
Wow, this has been wildly fascinating. So what's next for you and your family now that this season of this podcast is wrapped?
Well, there's a really funny thread throughout this podcast that when my dad was investigating it, he became obsessed with Dr. Phil. Because Dr. Phil airs on daytime New Zealand TV every day. I'm sure it does in the States.
That's right. You reached out to him to try to get him to look into this, correct?
Dad wrote him a pitch which he had put in Comic Sans font. So it wasn't the most professional thing. But Dad still brings up, and you hear it in the podcast, where I'm investigating this story for Australia's national broadcaster. And Dad keeps saying, but, you know, do you think it could be time to approach Dr. Phil again? And I'm just like, Dad, I'm investigating this. But so I think it would be a natural climax to the story and to end on our family and possibly Leslie, the con artist, being on Dr. Phil. So I hope that one day that happens. And who knows? There's a few kind of Netflix-y type people buzzing around, so maybe we'll get this thing on the screens at some point.
Well, Ollie, go ahead and tell people where they can find your podcast and give them all the information about it if they want to go ahead and download this and listen to it.
So it's the latest season of Unravel True Crime, and it's called Snowball. So if you just search on Apple Podcasts or Google or whatever you use, if you just search Unravel Snowball or just Snowball, you'll be able to find it. And I don't want to say I borrowed too heavily, but the artwork is influenced by the old Catch Me If You Can artwork. It's a picture of me with a microphone chasing Leslie across a globe. really hope that you can ever listen to it. It's a very much an American story as much as it is a New Zealand story.
That's Ollie Ward, the producer of that podcast, via Skype from Australia. KCBX News tried to track down the woman at the center of the podcast to get her viewpoint of the story. But despite several attempts to reach her by phone, we got her voicemail, but no return calls. We were also able to confirm that until recently, she did work at a San Luis Obispo grocery store, but she no longer works there. Ward's mentioned in our interview that other parties have been interested in telling his family's story, saying that both Dr. Phil and Dateline have expressed interest. He's also currently working on a follow-up episode. So this may not be the last we hear of this mysterious woman who may or may not still be living here on the Central Coast. You're listening to Issues and Ideas.